What you see on the left-hand map is the Christmas Island, the little island tucked away in the Indian Ocean. What you see on the right-hand map, your side, is the Caribbean Sea with the Cayman Islands put on the mark of the red circle. The Cayman Islands are about 20-hour boat ride away from the Christmas Islands, but no one is ever likely to make that trip. These islands belong to very different types of global circulation. The one is known for handling non-resident money, the other is known for processing non-resident subjects. The Christmas Islands have become infamous for its asylum seeker detention center, instituted by the Australian government with the aim of creating a hub for offshore processing of refugees. The Cayman Islands are infamous for status as an offshore financial center offering a hub for migrant money. These two islands can be described as heterotopias of liberal circulation. Both are juridical political spaces that have been instituted in order to manage and control global circulations of money on the one hand and subjects on the other. We want to look at these juridical political spaces as part of a liberal security dispositif, as Paul described it. To recall shortly, I'm sure you all know, that the liberal security dispositif defines a political technology that aims at governing circulation. Like other technologies of governing, the security has a spatial dimension, and we already heard about it in the presentation about the cattle. So you have the same quote that Chris read, I think, or I'm not sure. Firstly, the spatial circulation seeks to secure connections. This is Foucault. In other words, it was a matter of organizing circulation, eliminating its dangerous elements, making a division between good and bad circulation, and maximizing the good circulation by diminishing the bad. These spaces of security do not work, Foucault says, in an empty space, but they rely on material givens. They provide the space for possible events. Whereas sovereign power, Foucault says, seeks to govern territory by centralizing it geographically around the capital, the space of security is a horizontal milieu of possible movements. This horizontal milieu, Foucault specifies in the lectures on biopolitics, has a planetary horizon. So he describes its planetary horizon, but the second quote we put out there, it goes, there's no localization, no territoriality, there's no singular amalgamation in the total space of the market. In this account, the space of circulation and the geographical fixation of sovereign power are opposed to each other. The liberal security dispositif envisions, quote, an entire surface of the globe, unquote, at the space of circulation, and dispenses the sovereign territorial modes of power. This is Foucault, and he said that in one of his lectures. Although he qualified that kind of periodization of different technologies, but we can talk about that. And that's actually one of our first sort of intervention. We want to take up the notion of the space of security, but we want to challenge the marginalization of sovereign territories in Foucault's notion of the space of circulation. By looking at these heterotopias of circulation, we hope to show that territory is itself a part of the technologies of security. Thus, the planetary horizon correlates with territorial enclaves. We make our case by looking at two types of circulation, as said before, that of population and that of money. Our concern is to study how the good and the bad circulation of money and population in a planetary horizon is governed through territory. Now, for understanding how territory works in the context of the space of security, one has to untie the notion of territory from the understanding of the homogeneous and contiguous state territory. One has to look instead, a territory as a technology of power. And we are going back to the human geographer Robert Zach, who wrote in his classical study on human territoriality that territory should be understood as a technology of power that wishes to affect, to influence, and to control people, phenomena, and relationships by delimiting and asserting control over a geographic area. According to Zach, territoriality can be used on different levels, from the personal to the international, and for different purposes. As a particular technology of power, it performs two basic operations. Firstly, territory implies the delimitation of areas in order to establish different degrees of access to people, to things, or to relationships. Secondly, its effect is the constitution of inside-outside demarcations that can have different degrees of fixity and depth. Zach emphasizes that territory or territorial strategies are never purely geographical. Territory always requires non-territorial actions to back it up. Marking a territory might employ legal, symbolic, military, or other means for signaling and parceling out a certain area. Looking at territoriality as a composite of spatial and non-spatial practices that engender particular types of boundlessness allows for both sufficient focus and openness in understanding the phenomenon of offshore. It avoids the central binary and epochal renderings of the two eras of the territorial nation state on the one hand and the borderless space of the network on the other. So in sum, we look at the Christmas Islands and the Cayman Islands as paradigmatic cases of territorial strategies in the context of the liberal security dispositif. They are both zones of exception. Zones of bounded spaces which are exempt from the surrounding jurisdiction and constitute differential regulatory spaces. These spaces have been strategically set up. They are part of explicit political rationalities of government. These zones or enclaves are constructed, maintained, and championed in light of the planetary horizon of circulation that they intend to serve. We argue that one should not presume the world of global flows and nomadic capital to which the zone is fitting, but we have to study how these zones can employ territorial techniques for governing and for making these flows global and nomadic, as they are described. So,
yeah, the planetary horizon of liberalism that Foucault describes in his lectures on biopolitics is not only about the smooth space of the market, it is also about the universalization of law and citizenship. Immanuel Kant's text on perpetual peace is the example that Foucault discusses in this respect. This imaginary of universal law is still shared today. The universality of human rights, transnational law, and global constitutionalism, these are the buzzwords of legal globalizations. These visions renounce the category of territory, just as Foucault has done to a certain degree when he referred to Kant. But territorial techniques have not vanished, but assume a crucial role for deflecting abject populations in search for legal protection. Our exemplary case is the offshore processing center, or offshore processing regime, established by Australia in remote places, such as the detention facility on policy is the exemption of coastal areas from the Australian onshore. In 2001, the Australian government declared parts of its territory to be excised offshore places. These places were legally split off from the mainland. To enter Australia from now on meant to enter the migration zone, as the onshore was newly called, or the mainland. Conversely, to enter the excised places would mean to enter a zone that is not Australia. But one might ask, where is the zone instead? And what does this place do with the person entering it? Answering these questions, we believe, will help us to understand what it means to employ territory as a technique for governance global circulation. The decision of offshore places coincided with the creation of a distinct legal person, the offshore entry person, as it is called. This person possesses limited rights in comparison to the onshore claimant by arriving by boat and maybe only a few kilometers away from the mainland. Offshore entry persons neither have the same kind of legal assistance during refugee status determination, nor do they have access to the same kind of juridical review if their refugee claim should be declined. Moreover, definite and non-ambiguous criteria for decision-making are lacking in offshore processing. The immigration officers operate on the basis of draft manuals that are said to provide guidance only. Although the manuals refer to Australian legislation and case law, these norms are not considered to be strictly binding. Moreover, the decision by immigration officers themselves count only as recommendations. For offshore entry persons being able to apply for a visa, they also, and in the last step, depend on a discretionary act by the minister. Taken in sum, offshore processing constitutes the ghostly double of the legal procedures on the mainland. The inferior legal status of the onshore entry person is intimately tied to the territorial creation of a paradoxical not Australia. Not Australia, then, is a place that is not exactly Australia, but that at the same time does not belong to any other country. In relation to the mainland, the excised territories entertain a rather vexed relation to of inside and outside. On the one hand, the act of legal excision makes them appear to be clearly separated from Australia. Refugee claims uttered in the excised territories are mostly inaudible on the mainland. Furthermore, the determination process on Christmas Island has been conceived of as non-statutory, which means that Australian law is not binding. But on the other hand, the excised territories still remain tied to Australia. First of all, Australia used its territorial jurisdiction to create them. And moreover, the persons that arrive at these places are regarded as having trespassed onto Australian territory without a valid visa. For this reason, the Migration Act defines these persons as unlawful non-citizens. This means that people who enter one of the over 4,000 excised islands might be physically present in Australia and at the same time legally absent. But those who are held on the detention centers in these remote islands are not just legally absent, they also have been rendered invisible. Territorial strategies are built on the remoteness and inaccessibility of their location. The Christmas Islands are so small and remote that they are out of sight. A 70-year-old boy from Afghanistan who has been detained on the island puts it as follows. Quote him, when we studied geography, our teachers never showed us Christmas Island. If we look at a world map, Christmas Island is hiding in the map. It's so small. geography itself offers a wheel of secrecy, since the territorial equivalent controls both people entering and people leaving. So what does follow from this exemplary case? Most basically, governing men and things in a planetary horizon does not imply a dissolution of territory. The territoriality of the offshore rather becomes a material infrastructure for governing global populations. Offshores are regulatory spaces in a complex sense. They use legal techniques to stabilize peculiar relations to national and global law through inscriptions into geographical space. The territorial strategy partitions the global nomosphere and assembles these partitions with geographical distances. In this sense, the territory of offshore has an inbuilt normative status. It is a technology of carving the environment, coding proximity and remoteness, coding accessibilities and inaccessibilities. It regulates who and what is accountable and who has access to rights. Borrowing from Stuart Edelman, one might therefore say that the excised territories work, quote, within, between, and against existing territorial frames, end quote. They confuse the distinction between the Westphalian vision of sovereign territoriality and its liberal countervision of the deterritorialized New World Order. The excised territories instead prefer a topological folding. They turn the inside out in order to produce a heterotopia. A heterotopia that is neither a heterotopia of crisis nor a heterotopia of divines, but a heterotopia of control. It is on the one hand an infraphysics for governing global movements, changing their direction, slowing them, fixing them in space. But it also controls access to relationships of accountability and obligation. It molds access to rights and visibility. It fractures global law and produces an abject population with the status of an unlawful non-citizen.
So how different from these asylum offshores, where people are forced to the penalty on their own accord, financial offshores are easy to enter and easy to leave. Most people associate with the financial offshore like exotic landscapes, breastplates, beaches, nefarious businesses, and in some dirty money. But financial offshore is not just about dirty money, it's about global money. As the International Monetary Fund puts it, financial offshore centers both have captured a significant proportion of global financial flows. They have been dubbed laboratories for financial products, and all of the products you heard about in the context of the financial crisis, all these special purpose vehicles and CDOs and naked CEOs and synthetic CEOs and whatever, they have been sort of manufactured at these places. As Sharma says, the offshore finance industry proved so successful at repackaging debt that at diffusing risk that no one could be quite sure who owed what to whom, end of quote. Offshore sites like the Cayman Islands are used by multinational corporations, but also by pension funds, by university endowments, and insurances to handle cross-border relations of money. The Cayman Islands specifically are one of the oldest and well-established financial offshore centers. It is the fifth largest financial center in the world. It is the largest offshore mutual fund registration center and the second largest offshore insurance center. It hosts at least a third of globally operating hedge funds. One doesn't know this number exactly. Some people say it's 81%. Surrounded by secrecy, so the numbers diverge quite widely. In total, there are 72,949 offshore corporations which are registered at the Cayman Islands, and it's a domicile of $2 trillion of banking assets. So, financial offshores are territories for governing global money, but how does a territory work as a technique for governing money? For answering these questions, questions, one has to look at the peculiar space that offshore is about. Just as we ask in respect to the question of the population of the Christmas Island, we ask here, where and what is this stone, and what does it do to the money that enters it? So the first question, where and what is offshore? This question is actually really hard to answer. Each article on financial offshore will start with a comment of a troublesome effort to say what it is. Most say it's like in the eye of the beholder what offshore is. The difficulty of definition, one might say, resides in the complex relationality of the offshore. Offshores are off some shore, but which shore? All too often, offshore is only understood as a relation between a small island, as became an island, and some major industrialized nation, like the US, for example, which is then considered onshore. The relation usually between onshore and offshore is then described by the difference between the regulatory regimes and the tax regime that exists between the two places. Onshore and offshore are competing in this account for a presumed global flow of money. There is certainly truth to this narrative, but its analytical framing underestimates the internal cleavage that offshore is about. Offshore centers, like the Cayman Islands, are not simply off the shore of the USA, for example. They are off the shore of the Cayman Islands themselves. The foreign financial institutions registered at Cayman Islands have mostly the status of being exempt. That is, they are prohibited of trading with or providing services to the Cayman Islanders themselves. They are not allowed to offer their service to those that are their neighbors in physical space. Being offshore turns out to be about residing at a space while being exempted from it. And the status of being exempt grants legal presence to the companies, but requires no physical presence. And so it can be that we have this house, which is famous. This is the Ackman House on 201 Short Street in Georgetown. And it is the registered home for 18,857 financial institutions. They fit into the small building only because of the fact that most of them have not a physical presence there. These corporations pay a premium to reside legally, quote, somewhere other than they are actually located, unquote. This is Haven, who has written in this book on offshore. So what happens to the money that comes to the offshore place? And to put it in a nutshell, you could say all what classical sociologists assume that money is about, anonymous and fluid, this, all these attributes, money gets at those offshore places in a far more exotic sense than maybe usual cash or money circulating in other places has. So let's look at that closely, fluidity or liquidity of money. The essence, offshore modifies the relation between money and place. Money at the offshore place is from non-residents to non-residents. It never resides itself. As one fund manager explained, most customers never get that their money never actually is at the Cayman Islands. The IMF defines therefore offshore as a country or jurisdiction that provides financial service to non-residents on a scale that is incommensurate with the size and the financing of its domestic economy. The money that comes to the Cayman Islands is supposed to be the Cayman Islands. The way that works is that of what we all know about, that there are no taxes on the Cayman Islands. The corporations who handle money on these islands pay a fee, a premium for being there and for processing the money. And that actually has the effect, asking for no taxes, that the money is allowed to stay, as you could say with living seals, or unmarked. It can do whatever, they can recombine it and create sort of common portfolios in ways that are not possible in other national economies where money is traced and marked, so where does it come from, what kind of income is it for. So all these kind of markings of offshore space, because there the corporations only pay fees, that's how the Cayman Islands sort of create their revenue, but they don't pay taxes. So, but there's another aspect of like creating different or new attributes of money that the classical sociologists assume that money has in any case. This is the fact, or the anonymity of money. So what is, so it's not just the bifurcation of the physical and the legal presence, which is like decisive for the offshore, but it's also this privacy or secrecy laws. Such laws put the confidentiality between the banker and his client on par with the relation between a patient and a doctor, and while at the same time rendering it to be a crime to convey information to a third party. Money becomes therefore invisible at the offshore. Interestingly, the very specific privacy granted to money turns money into the very anonymous medium that classical sociology assumed it to be. Money becomes, through such laws, what it is supposedly all along, depersonalized and unmarked from any specific and restricted circulation, as Vivian Syriza has put it. So while the relation of ownership is absolutely secured, the relations from where money stems from, inclusion, liabilities, beneficiaries, or obligations are loosened or hidden. Money is unmarked from its whereabouts and can be freely combined. The offshore place thus constitutes money as a global and anonymous flow. It determines what kind of relation is made, what kind of relation is made to have, and which of them are visible to whom. So while money is easily understood to have the quality of being deterritorialized and boundless just by itself, looking at these offshore places shows that this quality is actually produced by the use of territory. If offshore is the global economy, as Bill Maurer has put it, and this quality might precisely reside in the particular combination of ownership, liability, and visibility.
I think they have already spoken much longer, only a very brief conclusion. We hope that our analysis of both Christmas and Cayman Islands demonstrates that the offshore is a juridical political zone, a zone that uses territory to institute a division between inside and outside, presence and absence, visibility and invisibility. This use of territory defies any purely geographical understanding of territory. We have seen that legal structures and the production of visibility play a very important role. The enclave also defies any simple understanding of a boundary that sheds the inside from the outside. Instead, we are confronted with territories that belong to a political legal space and do not belong to it at the same time. Boundaries are ambiguous, and this ambiguity is crucial for their government. The two cases demonstrate that territory is in each case a crucial political technology, but its role shifts. Territoriality works in one case to weaken legal protection, and in the other case it offers legal protection as a bulwark that shields from political obligations. The zone is in one case about enhancing money's fluidity and recombinatory powers, and in the other case it's about undoing the possibilities of subjects to negotiate their legitimate modes of movement. We cannot infer from the offshore to what use it is put. But one thing our work shows for certain, that we should not be forced to choose between the planetary horizon of space of circulation on one hand and the sovereign governing of territory, as Foucault at some points seems to suggest. We need to study how territory is a technique